Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union. Welcome to another episode of NXIVM on Trial. The group's now-convicted co-founder, Keith Raniere, is tucked away in federal prison, likely for the rest of his life. But the NXIVM saga is still ongoing. High-ranking members of its inner circle still await sentencing dates, and a small faction of former NXIVM members remain loyal to the man they called Vanguard, as Raniere attempts to clear his name on appeal. The NXIVM story is the focus of a new book titled Don't Call It a Cult by Vancouver-based investigative reporter Sarah Berman, a former senior editor at Vice. Berman was among the reporters, alongside our own Rob Gavin, who covered the entirety of Raniere's nearly two-month trial in 2019 in U.S. District Court in Brooklyn, where he was convicted of sex trafficking, forced labor conspiracy, wire fraud, and racketeering charges that included extortion, identity theft, child exploitation, and possession of child pornography. The book takes a three-part dive into the rise of NXIVM, from the capital region to Canada and Mexico, to its leaders' elusive ability to avoid legal consequences, and the probe that inevitably took Raniere and several other top NXIVM leaders down. Sarah Berman recently sat down with Rob Gavin to talk about the book. Here's some of their conversation.
Sarah, what can you tell me about this book, Don't Call It a Cult? I love the beginning of it and the way you've really brought a personal side to this, but if you could put in your own words, what made you want to write the book? What attracted you to it?
My draw to NXIVM really was sparked by my realization that I had sort of friends and colleagues who were pretty closely associated, who had taken the classes, you know, who maybe had a roommate who moved to Albany, or, you know, who went to high school with someone like Nikki Klein, who to this day remains loyal to Keith Raniere. So because this sort of cohort of people were such progressive, left-leaning, you know, maybe bike riding type vegetarian Vancouverites, I wanted to really square that with this branding scheme and this blackmail scheme and, you know, all the dark things that sort of came out at trial. So those things hadn't quite come out yet, but I was already just trying to solve this riddle of how did this cohort of people become involved in something that got so dark. And that really motivated me because it seemed so upside down. And I had so many upside down moments with NXIVM. And just to touch on the title a little bit, for the record, I don't mind if anybody calls NXIVM a cult. I think experts who have reviewed it see all the red flags. It checks off all the boxes. But because NXIVM was sort of this full of misdirection and gaslighting, and, you know, and nobody who joined ever thought it was a cult. And in fact, everybody, you know, strongly denied that right up until the end. You know, even when I first met Sarah Edmondson, she was freshly out in October 2017. And she was scared to call NXIVM a cult at that time. She thought she could potentially face legal backlash. She was already, you know, being chased. Claire Bronfman had flown out here to Vancouver to try and press charges against her.
This was a way that NXIVM intimidated people. We all know about the legal hell on the civil side that people face, but you're absolutely right that in the case of Sarah Edmondson, trying to get criminal charges, and there were some others there too.
It was not unprecedented for that to happen, right? That had happened to previous members as well. So yeah, that was my introduction, my first upside down moment, first of many, where, you know, something seemed off. I didn't understand why she couldn't just come out and say, okay, yes, it was a cult. You know, we wore sashes, we bowed to our leader who we called Vanguard. We were, you know, our diets and sleep were all controlled. I think that just really sets the tone for this book where, you know, you're sort of exposed to different layers of secrecy and deception. And it becomes, I guess, like that frog in water that slowly, slowly turns up the heat. And then by the end, you've got the full Nexium sort of experience, the deepest and the darkest parts. And yeah, I kind of thought you needed all that space. You needed 300 pages to really get there to the point where you can understand what it looked like from the inside. Because when you're doing those quick hits, you know, at the trial, you and I both know trying to file and get, you know, maybe 5 quotes in there. That doesn't tell the whole story. You need a lot more to just understand the path that people took into this, because they were idealists. They wanted to make a difference. They wanted to help people around them achieve their goals. That was the reason why they joined, not to become branded. So yeah, I just thought that needed to be told, especially from a journalistic perspective, because we have seen some memoirs about this. And I do think that's an important perspective as well. But to just bring it together and make sure all the main voices that helped expose this story got enough space.
Like you mentioned, a lot of other memoirs, other people have written books, including Sarah Edmondson, who has the book Scarred, and Tony Natale, obviously Catherine Oxenberg, among others. We've seen that, The Vow on HBO, which we both know, we saw the makers of that on a daily basis, as well as the people making Stars. And I really enjoyed working with people on both those shows, as well as, you know, the other programs like Dateline, and who was also covered in, and obviously CNBC with American Greed.
So much coverage.
There's so much coverage of this case. And that's just not even naming everybody, but I do think that when you look at it on a daily basis, it is kind of hard sometimes to just sort of, you know, how do you explain that? I think there was every day at the trial, I would always say, well, it can't get weirder than this. There can't be a moment where it gets stranger than this. And yet it always seemed to just get stranger and more bizarre. I think one of the things I noticed about your book in the beginning is it's very cool that it's dedicated to women who change their minds. And right. and I think, you know, the big story about Nexium, and I think what this book really does a good job too, is it's like, you know, these other books out there are from certain perspectives. This is the first book that really gives you the kitchen sink, that really gives you an outsider's perspective, someone who's familiar with the case but wasn't inside. There isn't this was what happened to me when I was in it. This is someone who looked at it very closely and was able to just kind of talk to a huge number of people. I mean, everybody from Sarah Edmondson, you spoke to Dennis Yusko.
Yes, a favorite among journalists, I must say. So all my, you know, colleagues in Vancouver are like, man, I love Dennis Yusko. He's great. That's great.
What you've done is really provided a huge, like, kitchen sink approach. But within that, you also, what I really like is, like, you show how, like, Sarah Edmondson tried to basically pitch it to you as she tried to sell you on Nexium. What was that like?
So that was so important for me to understand what it looked like from the ground, you know, going into it. And I didn't expect it actually to come across as so gentle. I expected sort of a hard sell and maybe really intense pressure tactics, maybe for her to pounce on my insecurities, right? I was sort of feeding her my personal insecurities, almost hoping that she would take a more aggressive approach to sort of stripping me down and saying, you really need to work on this. But that didn't come until much later. So she actually just made it sound like a gentle chat between friends. She talked about what a blue sky scenario would look like if I had been able to, you know, address all of what I thought my deficiencies might be and you know, really resolved my inability to commit all these sort of light growth themes that I was bringing up, and really imagine that fantasy future for myself. And then she sort of goes, and what do you think that pattern costs you, this, you know, inability to commit? And she made me come up with a number, like in dollars. And it turned out, I mean, I just pulled $10,000 out of the air. And she goes, well, great, because our program only costs $3,000.
That is interesting. Did you hear that pitch? And did it sound like something that was then intriguing to you? I know, obviously, you didn't.
Yeah. I probably wouldn't have gone just off of that pitch, but I could see it. I could see and feel sort of what that was like. And I did sort of come to the conclusion that someone who is prone to fantasy and, you know, is moved by visual and kinetic images would sort of be drawn to that. I could totally see how it could sort of get somebody in the door, get somebody to try something new. You know, like there's lots of people in Vancouver and around the world who want new experiences, who want to try maybe even extreme things, right? And so I understood that mentality, you know, having been someone who, as a, you know, in my early 20s, did a bunch of kind of extreme or edgy things, you know, that really did sort of speak to me. But to go back to something you said earlier, in terms of, yeah, the kitchen sink perspective, I think there was just so much that people like Sarah Edmondson just didn't know, you know, like there was so much that she learned after the trial, because so many things were just hidden and obscured. Just secrets were this weapon, essentially, in the hands of Ranieri and his followers. So I think you needed to sort of wait even until the sentencing. There were still new revelations revealed in the victim impact statements. Those were news to even the most, you know, loyal and connected followers. So I hope that people do get more perspective, not just on, yeah, the experiences of people from the inside, but also the structure of it, how it worked, how the manipulation tactics got somebody to, you know, change their opinions over a period of years, right? Like it was a slow reprogramming process that's actually similar to, you know, like re-education camps, you know, right? Like Robert J. Lifton, he studied prisoners of war who had come back from Korea in the 50s and identified these 8 criteria for thought reform. And psychologists who studied this program, like the self-help classes itself, found these 8 criteria. So really powerful military grade stuff. So yeah, I wanted to sort of peel back the layers and show that structure and that process as well.
You're able to touch on a lot of different areas. Like it's not, even though you're based in Vancouver, you were able to talk to Dennis. You were able to, you know, come to the Capital Region. When you were in town after the trial, we drove up around Knox Woods, and Knox Woods, that's the unofficial, was basically the unofficial headquarters for where I always say more than 24, but I think it's a lot more than even that, members of NXIVM lived. What was it like just seeing that? I don't know if that was the first time you saw it or not, but like going
through, I think that was my second trip through Knox Woods, but it was a very memorable one because remember we had not that long ago heard about how his followers, Keith's followers, thought that he could control the weather. And then right. When you and I went through, there was this big thunderstorm, just this sort of storm. It really felt fun to sort of joke about Keith's powers over the weather. And yeah, just see how tightly wound it is. It's sort of a maze of streets that kind of enclose over each other. You can easily feel lost. And it's not connected really to the outside world. You can't just pass through without needing a destination in Knox Woods. So I found all of that super enlightening.
And as we now know from watching The Vow and seeing some videos, Keith Ranieri, of course, referred to, and if I'm misquoting him here, of course, all apologies due to the Vanguard, I say in jest, he referred to Clifton Park as the, I think he said the jewel of the civilized world, or he called it like the Rome of the civilized world.
That sounds right. Yes, the Rome.
the Rome, and nothing against Clifton Park, but it is about as cookie cutter suburbia as you will find. I don't know that longtime residents of Clifton Park would compare it to Rome, maybe the suburbs of Rome, New York, maybe. Speaking of Keith Raniere, there's a part after the book you have in an appendix where you wrote a letter. It's part of a letter you wrote to Keith Raniere when he was in the federal detention center in Brooklyn, which of course our readers and our listeners will know. This is where Keith Raniere's followers, the people such as Nikki Klein and a lot of other, Michelle Hatchett, among others, you know, who were singing, dancing for Keith outside the prison walls. But, you know, you wrote a letter to him, reaching out to him. And I love what you wrote here, where you say you want to ask questions. Forgive me for cutting to the chase. Many people have put immense faith in your intellect and ability over the years. They have trusted you with their life savings, their psychological trauma, their medical decisions. Do you think they were right to place that faith in you? Why or why not? And then you go on to say, when people say you are the smartest, most ethical man in the world, do you believe them? Why or why not? That's a great question to ask him, because we all know that's what members of NXIVM believe. They all believe he was the most ethical man in the world. There was this lie, if I can say that, this myth that he was built up. And we saw Mark Vicente testify, like, he heard so much that by the time you met him, I think he said that he was like a god, that he hears all this stuff about him. And then he sees him and he's like, oh, this is the guy? So talk a little bit about like writing that letter to Keith and if you heard anything back from him.
I kept coming around to this question in my head, you know, how much of the hype does Keith Raniere himself actually believe, right? Like, I can speculate about how much he may have believed in himself as this most ethical, smartest man, and how much he just needed other people to believe it. But I really just needed to go to him for that answer. So yeah, I did write that letter, I would say like last summer, I think it was June, was the first time I mailed it out. I didn't, to be honest, expect a response, at least not right away. But by the time The Vow came out in the fall, and he seemed to have at least had one jailhouse call with the HBO team, that's when I was like, okay, I want to get this answered. But unfortunately, yeah, I just haven't heard back. The last time I sent it again was when he switched legal teams in February, I think it was. He's got a new team for his appeal. I sent it to his new lawyers just to make sure it was on the record, but still have yet to hear a response. I'm not sure, you know, what his communication with his legal team is like. You know, we're still under COVID lockdown in a lot of places, especially prisons. It's pretty risky. So yeah, have not heard a response yet, but you know, I would still absolutely look to publish those results if Keith ever gets back to me.
I don't know what Keith Raniere could tell us, honestly, that we haven't already heard in a trial or whatnot. What got me, and I don't know if you had the same view of this, when we heard his reaction, his voice in letters, and we saw the way he was reacting to trying to, quote unquote, get scrutiny on the judge, trying to, you know, reach out and get support. It's like, to me, as I looked at it, it was like nothing had changed. Like, he was exactly the same guy that we saw in testimony and saw otherwise.
It's interesting. I feel like because he still has true believers, that there's still, you know, he still thinks he has some narrow chance at driving a wedge of doubt into the case, right? He doesn't have to prove, you know, fully that he didn't do it. He doesn't have to say, oh, it was somebody else, I plead the fifth, or anything like that. It's like, he just has to create enough doubt that somehow, you know, that I imagine that that's his legal team's thinking. That's speculation, but that seems to be what's driving this appeal. But yeah, we're not learning anything new. We're not learning any new evidence. If anything, they've been trying to sort of create doubt outside a court setting, right? Like, you have the team, including Nikki Klein, trying to say there was tampering with the child porn evidence.
That's right.
but not in a courtroom, right? Like Agnifilo seemed to actually say in court, I think, that he wouldn't allow that filing, but that his followers announced it anyway, sort of on the steps of the court. So yes, this battle is being waged mostly outside of court, and it's just trying to sow some doubt in the main witnesses. I can see why that would be a strategy, just because there is such a range of beliefs. You know, you have people like Nikki who does not believe she's a victim, and that's fine. Personally, I think she's gone through a gauntlet of things, and you know, she can hold those beliefs, but her beliefs can't change the actions, you know, the actual yeah. events that happened. It's an interesting and gray area, but do I think an outcome is going to change? I mean, I certainly can't predict, but it doesn't seem like there's new evidence coming through.
Essentially, Keith Raniere's chance at a new trial is he's going to appeal, and he already has began the process, to the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in Manhattan, and there'll be three judges that will listen to it. Sarah, one of the questions I wanted to ask you about this is, what was it like coming from Canada to cover the American law enforcement system? Was that, did that provide challenges you didn't expect? I mean, what was it like to come from? I mean, we don't always think of Canada as another country, maybe the way we would have a country that's further away. But what was your experience?
It was a speedy education. Obviously, the PESO system I'd used before lightly, but not nearly to the degree that I ended up with this case. PACER system being the sort of online document system that a lot of journalists in the US use. It was definitely, I mean, just the high profileness was something that you never see in Canada. So having that camaraderie between the journalists, and as well just being just there day after day for 6 weeks, truly a unforgettable experience. And I really did start to get just sort of invested, right? Like now I kind of need to get back to New York, especially for the sentencings. You know, we're still waiting on Allison Mack's sentencing. We're still waiting on Lauren Salzman's sentencing and a couple others. I really do feel, yeah, an attachment to New York, and I hope to get back.
Keith Raniere was sentenced 120 years in prison, which he's 60 years old, so that's a life sentence, bearing his success at appeal. Claire Bronfman, she's NXIVM's former director of operations, she was expected to get, even on the feds only asked for about, I think, 5 years max, and she faced 21 to 27 months, and she was absolutely slammed with nearly 7 years in prison. And the judge was pretty clearly disgusted by her conduct in the case. So that's where the case are. You know, Lauren Salzman, star witness for the prosecution, she is still facing sentencing on racketeering related charges. We have ongoing sentencings which still have to happen for her mother, the former NXIVM president, Nancy Salzman. Kathy Russell is still to be sentenced as well. And, you know, as Allison Mack, of course, to me is sort of the most interesting one, because I think the majority of those defendants, to an extent or more, there's been cooperation. Is it to the level of Lauren Salzman, where she got on a witness stand and basically figuratively put the knife in Keith Raniere's back? No, but it was there. So to me, the Allison Mack will be the most fascinating part of it. Sarah, where can people get your book? If you want to know the story of NXIVM, and it's called Don't Call It a Cult, it's got a great photo on the cover. I love the photo on the cover. What is the photo of? You don't mind me asking.
I mean, I do think it's a stock photo, but it does represent sort of the late night Albany walk, I would say, right? So in the book, I describe the houses as sort of cookie cutter, like pieces in a Monopoly board game. And I think this house on the side really represents that. And the fact that, yeah, Keith Raniere was going on long walks in the middle of the night with all of his slaves in his inner circle. So that's sort of the mood the cover is setting. And you can find it, I mean, obviously Amazon stocks it, or if you want to support your local indie bookstore, you can go to bookshop.org and search it. Don't Call It a Cult, Sarah Berman. is the author name there.
Don't Call It a Cult, subtitled The Shocking Story of Keith Raniere and the Women of NXIVM. I can tell you, as someone who covered the trial along with Sarah, that Sarah knows this case like few others, really as a Vancouver perspective. I don't think anybody else has, and has just a general perspective. Like I said, that kitchen sink. Sarah, what is it you'd like to say about the book, NXIVM, the trial, anything that we didn't touch upon that you think should be in the podcast?
I would just expand on that dedication there, women dedicated to women who changed their minds. I think in NXIVM, there was this push to be consistent in your thinking and to always make the same decisions, even when presented with new unsettling information. And that did become what so many women in the trial called a trap. You know, a lot of women testified to feeling trapped in the sort of closed loop of logic that NXIVM created. And yeah, I just wanted people to know, whether you're potentially associated with a group like this or are potentially just in a abusive relationship, because so many things apply to domestic abuse that we heard in this trial, that you can change your mind. You can absolutely, when presented with new information, change what you think about a group or a person like Keith Raniere, just because you have talked him up as a, you know, genius philosopher in the past, doesn't mean you can't reassess that based on information that comes out. And I know that seems sort of like a simple, obvious thing, but it's such a powerful thing to observe with the testimony in this trial.
Thanks for listening to another episode of NXIVM on Trial. We'll be back with more as the case unfolds. And please remember that the Times Union's coverage of NXIVM and our other Watchdog reporting is supported by subscribers. If you're not a subscriber to the Times Union, please consider becoming one. Thanks again for listening. I'm Casey Seiler, editor of the Times Union.
If you're enjoying this podcast, take advantage of all the Times Union has to offer and support our efforts to bring in you award-winning journalism by becoming a Times Union member today. Go to timesunion.com/subscribe.